roll, please.
Right, Bob, let us know when we're good.
The AGP video, we are ready when you are.
Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Morning. Nice to see everybody.
Hey, Maria. Welcome to the July 23, 2020 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. Let's start by establishing a quorum with a roll call alphabetically, starting with Judge Damrell.
I'm a present.
Hey, Rainey here.
Otto here.
Maria?
Aranian here.
Viegas here.
Zingali here.
Satayan here. We have a quorum. We do not have a closed session today. If any member of the public is interested in providing public comment, please send an email blue card to the clerk at engage@deltacouncil.ca.gov, as shown on the screen. Be sure to note your name and the agenda item that you wish to comment on. Also, please note if you wish to speak or would like the clerk to read your comment. Please do this as soon as possible. When your name is called, the clerk will unmute your line or read your comment if requested. Let's move on to agenda item 5, the consent calendar. On the consent calendar today is the approval of the June 25, 2020 meeting summary. Is there any discussion?
If not, Viegas moves the item.
Second.
Okay.
Otto will second.
Okay, I think I heard Oscar Viegas motion to approve the meeting summary, and Mike Gatto seconding the motion. Okay, let's take the vote alphabetically, starting with Judge Damrell.
Damrell, aye.
Irini, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Marani, and aye.
Viegas, aye.
Zingali, aye.
And Tatai, and aye. That was not agenda item 5. That was agenda item 3. We're on to agenda item 4, the chair's report. For the chair's report, I'll ask Amanda Bowl to give us a quick summary of the highlights of the July 13, 2020 Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee meeting.
Great. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Tatayan and council members. As Chair Tatayan mentioned, the DPIC met last Monday, July 13th, and this was the first remote DPIC meeting. And we were very pleased to see and to hear, rather, that dialogue was still robust despite the screens in front of us and between us. As is the norm at DPIC meetings, we really try to have committee members discuss topics that are central to the Delta. And on July 13th, the committee members discussed ecosystem-based management and One Delta, One Science. And specifically during this meeting, two themes were explored. First, how can DPIC continue to build on, integrate, or learn from existing programs to accelerate ecosystem-based management in the Delta watershed? So to ground this discussion, committee members heard presentations from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation on the Central Valley Project Improvement Act, as well as from the Department of Water Resources on the incidental take permit for the state water project. The second theme focused on what actions DPIC can take to achieve ongoing, consistent, and reliable science funding. And these agenda items highlighted actions stemming from the Delta Science Funding and Governance Initiative. This included an update by Dr. Steve Brandt from the Delta ISB on the upcoming Science Needs Assessment Workshop and the discussion series that has been occurring since late May to queue up many of the ideas to be discussed during the workshop. And the next virtual discussion is actually next Tuesday, July 28th. So I encourage you all to tune into that if you can. This agenda item or the series of agenda items also included an update on the process to update the science action agenda. Delta Science Program staff, Henry DeBay and Rachel Kloppenstein, presented an update mentioning that this particular science action agenda update includes the identification of management questions. And so Henry and Rachel queried the committee members via Mentimeter to find out what management questions are important to them and their agencies. And a couple of examples of what came up out of that were, what is the best set of actions to accelerate recovery of species, and how will new long-term operations affect species of concern? And obviously there are many others. And so as part of that process, Henry and Rachel and their team are working to kind of distill all of these from both DPIC as well as from a survey that has been up for about a month, I believe. And finally, Mario Monzo from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation presented the first Delta Crosscut Budget Report. Reclamation and Council staff took the lead for DPIC in collecting, analyzing, and presenting Delta Science funding data for fiscal year 2018-2019. And as Chair Tatayan states in the foreword to the report, the inaugural Delta Crosscut Budget Report represents DPIC's first attempt to establish and implement a process for collecting data related to Delta Science funding. And this report can be viewed as an initial data point informing our effort to make science funding more effective. So we're already looking at how we can make the collection process better for the next reporting cycle. And I encourage you all to take a look at the report, which is available on the Council's website under the meeting materials from last week's DPIC meeting. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from the Council? Okay, sounds like there are no questions. I want to compliment Amanda on all her hard work to pull these DPIC meetings together. And I'll note that at this particular DPIC meeting, the discussion was animated mostly by Regional Director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Paul Souza, who noted that Dan Castleberry is retiring. So there was a fair amount of discussion among the community about how much Dan's knowledge will be missed in all his contributions. Okay, with that, let's move on to agenda item 5, Executive Officer's Report with Jessica Pearson.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to start with a regular reminder of how the council is operating during the COVID emergency. In support of the state's efforts to combat the spread of COVID-19, our office remains closed. However, staff continue to work remotely and they're available to assist the public at any time. In addition, our public meetings are going to be held remotely until further notice. To contact staff at the council, anyone can email hello@deltacouncil.ca.gov to be directed to the appropriate staff person. And anyone interested in participating in council activities or programs can sign up for our listserv or check on our website or social media, where we post frequent information about council public meetings and any updates for how to participate. Appropriate perhaps for a summer month, we did not have any Delta Plan implementation and coordination letters over the last 4 weeks, and there are currently no pending covered action certifications. I do have some personnel announcements. Dan Constable, previously a senior environmental scientist at the council, has been promoted to environmental program manager, and this is in our ecosystem, land use, and science integration unit in the planning and performance division. While at the council, Dan has been instrumental to the planning team in supporting our covered actions efforts and others, and we are excited as he takes up leadership of the unit. We have also onboarded virtually two new staff members. Chelsea Batavia is a new environmental scientist in the Delta Science Program's Science-Based Adaptive Management Unit. She recently completed her PhD at Oregon State University. She will support the science program's work to promote science-based adaptive management, in particular focusing on the human dimensions. This is related to the social science efforts that we've been spearheading. We will also be supporting the work of the Delta Independent Science Board in order to help design surveys and interviews to inform some of the reviews that the board is undertaking. And finally, Morgan Chow joins us as a senior environmental planner in the Ecosystem, Land Use, and Science Integration Unit of our planning division. She comes to us from BCDC, the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, where she worked on a variety of projects in the San Francisco Bay along the shoreline. Morgan has a BS in environmental policy analysis and planning from UC Davis and a master's in marine resource management from Oregon State. She's going to be supporting ongoing efforts to complete our ecosystem amendment and also helping us with our Delta Adapts climate adaptation project. So welcome to both Chelsea and Morgan. Our outreach highlights report and active projects reports are in your binder. They're also available on our website. There's no legal update today, and the legislative update is simply the list of bills tracked in your packet. If you have any questions about those, please feel free at any time to reach out directly to me or to Bethany. This month, we've included our quarterly contract and budget update. Those were provided to you in advance of the meeting. They're also available on our website. Any questions about those, feel free to reach out to myself or to Mary Ray. Mm-hmm. And unless there are any questions at this point, I think I'm going to yield the floor as part of my presentation to my two co-executive directors at our Delta sister agencies. We've got today Eric Vink, the executive director for the Delta Protection Commission, and also joining us Campbell Ingram, executive officer for the Delta Conservancy, to provide updates to you and to the public about the activities that they're undertaking relevant to Delta Plan implementation and their respective missions. So unless there are any questions, then I'm gonna turn it over to Eric Vink.
Any questions? Okay. Good morning, Campbell and Eric.
Good morning, Chair Tatiana and council members, and thank you, Jessica. Shall I jump in right now?
Please.
Wonderful. A few items I wanted to provide an update from the Delta Protection Commission. First off, the commission has been meeting regularly. We had a brief meeting last week, and we'll meet again in September. What I wanted to update the council on today are really two items. Excuse me. Actually, three items. The first is the update of our economic sustainability plan. The second is briefly on the National Heritage Area. And then finally, a few words about the work we're doing related to the Delta Conveyance Project. To start with the update of the Economic Sustainability Plan, I believe it was I have completely lost track of time. It might've been 9 months ago. It might've been more than a year ago. When both Campbell and I presented to the council, at that time, I provided a pretty detailed overview of the snapshot picture of agriculture in the Delta, at least as it existed in 2016. And that's a part of our update of the Economic Sustainability Plan, is to revise the agricultural snapshot, land use, the value of agriculture in the Delta. And as you'll recall, what I reported at that time was that Delta agriculture is more valuable. It mirrors the trends in California agriculture, which is a movement toward higher value crops. In the case of the Delta, we're a little late to get on the almond craze, but we have seen significant increases in almond plantings, continued increases in wine grape production, and increases in olive production as well. Those are the primary permanent crop increases. Linked to that report of the snapshot in Delta Ag was to compare that with anticipated restoration actions, at least as they are identified in EcoRestore. And I don't know if that was the part I reported on in detail, and I'm not going to go into great detail on it today, other than to say that the planned restoration activities are not anticipated to have a significant effect on Delta agriculture, probably due to the fact that many of those restoration projects have been in a slow transition away from agriculture, in some cases over a great period of time. And so we don't have high value active agriculture on a lot of those parcels currently. Some of them are being proposed in areas that never were really that productive agriculturally because they just aren't really well suited to farming. They're really more well suited for being restored to a natural condition. So not a lot of impact to agriculture from proposed restoration actions. And then the other two components of our update on the economic sustainability plan as it relates to agriculture is that we took a look at climate impacts on Delta agriculture. And basically, what does it mean for increasing summer and winter temperatures? And what does it mean for an approximate 5 foot of sea level rise by the end of this century? And of special concern were the chill-sensitive perennial fruit and nut trees in the Delta. And this is something Vice Chair Fiorini knows well. Cherries, pears, and walnuts in particular would be sensitive to those increasing wintertime temperatures. And then the increasing summertime temperatures would be of concern for heat-sensitive vegetable crops. But what the Delta is contending with is not any different from what Central Valley agriculture is contending with in terms of climate impacts. We just have that added overlay of sea level rise having a direct effect on the Delta region. And what does that mean? Certainly means that levees continue to need to be maintained and improved and even heightened in response to that sea level rise. And that was the primary finding coming out of that. Excuse me. And then finally, we had a very technical report that goes well beyond my level of comprehension that looked at salinity effects and specifically whether there's any evidence that salinity in the water column has affected Delta crop choice. And I think the short message from that report is that it's hard to find a direct connection between salinity in Delta water and the crop choices that farmers are making. It's far more true that farmers are making their crop choices based on agricultural economics. But in terms of making the connection between salinity, not a real conclusive finding. Our researchers do support some additional study in that area. That's something that the commission will be looking at as we move further down the road. So that's kind of the big picture on the ag update of the economic sustainability plan. We'll be transmitting these reports to the council and frankly to any interested parties very soon. We'll post the most digestible of the reports on our website. The others are going to be very difficult to put in a format that we can post on our website, but we will make them available to whomever is interested in them. So at the same time that we're kind of wrapping up our ag update of the economic sustainability plan, we're knee deep in updating the recreation and tourism chapter. And at our commission meeting last week, we did update our commissioners on some focus groups that were very interesting in terms of the comments they unearthed from either recreation operators, recreation users, people who might want to even recreate in the Delta region. And those focus groups were additionally interesting because we initiated them before the pandemic and then we continued them in the early stages of the pandemic, but they will inform the update of the recreation and tourism chapter, as will the continued synthesis of different studies and reports that have been prepared, some by the commission and some by other entities such as state parks. And then finally, a recommendation on what additional research might be necessary to help better inform the picture of the recreation and tourism economy in the Delta region. So covered a lot of ground there on the economic sustainability plan update. Let me just conclude real quickly by saying our planning for the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta National Heritage Area, and I think everyone is aware, but if you're not, the Delta is the first National Heritage Area. This is a federal designation. Congress passed its legislation in March of 2019. We're proceeding on our development of the required management plan. The Delta Protection Commission is the management entity for the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta National Heritage Area. And in the fall, we'll be going out with the first components of the management plan and seeking input from our very interested stakeholders. So more to come on that in the near future. And then finally, I just wanted to say about the Delta Conveyance Project. We've been working with both DWR personnel working on the conveyance project. We've been working with the Design and Construction Authority. You all are probably aware that they have a very active stakeholder engagement committee that brings together people from throughout the Delta region. They just met yesterday afternoon, in fact, and the engineering and design is coming into much greater focus for that proposal. There's an opportunity to get feedback from the stakeholder engagement committee on those proposals. And I just want to say that we've been very appreciative, the staff of the Delta Protection Commission, with how much more information and transparency even there is on this project as opposed to its predecessors, Cal Water Fix and BDCP. We're in regular conversation with the personnel at DWR. We found those conversations to be very helpful. Doing a lot of the engineering up front is incredibly helpful for people in the Delta region to really understand the full impact of this proposed project. There's probably still going to be much opposition to it, and there will undoubtedly be a lot that we will be gravely concerned about for this project. But it's really just a breath of fresh air to see the different approach this time coming out of DWR in particular. So I probably took a lot more time than I should have, but you caught me in a chatty mood. I'm happy to answer any questions you all might have for me.
Thank you, Eric.
I have a question.
Maria, go ahead.
I have two questions. One is that when you were doing the report, you talked about there are areas that were never very strong or conducive of agricultural uses. And what has been the state of them and how is the protection in case of these land being implemented? What do we want to make out of them? Or how do we want to protect them?
Well, the properties I was specifically referring to have been identified for restoration, and either the restoration is underway, in some cases it's relatively complete in terms of getting it all prepared for nature to take over and for it to restore on its own through natural functions in the coming years. But these are all properties that have been identified for restoration. And so what we were unable to do is to go back and take a real good historic look at, you know, say a parcel that is currently the subject of a restoration. At what point was it agricultural? And then when did it make that transition away from agriculture? Or perhaps when did it make a transition from higher value agriculture to a less intensive use in preparation for the ultimate restoration of the project? But what we found was if there was active agriculture, it was fairly low value. We didn't see any instances where there was a high value crop there in 2014, say, and that it was completely converted away from that by the time the restoration process began. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes, in a way, I'm trying to still understand that. How do we define the restoration for each of these properties? And, well, natural restoration is a part of it, but when we say restoration, is to restore them to what? You know, I know it's case by case.
Yeah.
Has been, but what are some of the examples of it?
Yeah, well, a tidal marsh restoration would be one where you reintroduce tidal functions to a property, and the property is at the right elevation so it can restore. And the restoration ecologists are probably cringing right now at my simplistic explanation. But the other is there's wetland restoration projects that are occurring where, you know, you're just flooding up a certain property to promote the establishment of wetland type vegetation. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that helps, but it
does.
Those are probably to
go back to be an agricultural land. In some cases, it's water storage. In some cases, it depends of what it was or what it could be. The potential of the, when we say restoration, it means many things, and I'm trying to see. My question was, what is exactly restoration? And it could be different from one land to the other. And what is the attempt to bring it back to its what era, what use, and how we define all that?
Yeah, probably the one common feature is that there's a very active management role to make this happen. So it's not just where you abandon a piece of farmland and let nature take over. There's more active involvement to alter the water features, to do perhaps grading on the property, to change the elevations on the property to make it more suitable for the ultimate restored purpose. But there's an active involvement of people and usually heavy equipment at the start of this process to make it suited for the natural functions to ultimately, restore it over time.
That take over, is that like, let's say if a property owner says, you know, I want to do this, and this land really is not conducive for at certain, what rules govern that? The restoration, are there restoration guidelines that says, no, you can't make this, I don't know, whatever that this person wants to make it?
Yeah, that there probably is someone else that could better explain that, because I'm getting way out on a very thin limb here in terms of my understanding and expertise. But I mean, the Delta Plan plays a certain role in terms of identifying areas that are most suited for restoration. But I think what's true is that a landowner that wanted to do this, as long as they didn't need required permits, if they just want to stop farming some of their land and let more natural vegetation take over the property, there's really nothing standing in the way for them to do that. And again, I don't know if that answers your question, but I probably should defer to someone else on where you're going with those questions, because it's certainly not my expertise.
Sure. And, I have one more question on the, when you were talking about the Delta, the EIR, or not the EIR, the engineering work and all that, is the project definition really clear right now, and everybody knows what it is, and the sentiments are more positive? I mean, is that what you thought it is, or you said?
Well, you're talking about the Delta Conveyance Project, the single tunnel. More details are emerging all the time. I think I was at least surprised to learn from yesterday's meeting that one of the intakes that was proposed in the scoping is now off the table. For those of you following, intake two, no longer being considered for the project. And so, those details are emerging all the time. I wouldn't say that there's a sudden love affair with the project from the Delta. Everyone's still pretty much opposed to it. But I think there is appreciation for the fact that the people designing, doing the engineering and the design of it are listening and at least in some instances are responsive to the concerns they're hearing. You know, for instance, they're coming to this group and they're saying, we're anticipating a tunnel shaft location on this property. Tell us the problems with that. And then people say, oh, that road is, you know, important for emergency vehicle traffic. I'm just making up an example here. That would be a very bad location. Okay, the engineering team goes back and they say, well, here's the modification we've made to that. Mm. And in the hypothetical example I provided, it's a good modification. It avoids the problem that would have been created by placing at one location. It might create other problems by placing it at a different location. But there's appreciation for the fact that there's input into that, as opposed to here's our fully baked idea. We're presenting in an environmental impact report, and there was no opportunity to have any input on the features of that.
Thank you very much. I have no more questions. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks, Maria. Any other questions from other council members? Okay. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eric, very much. And I think a lot of Maria's questions get at exactly what kind of guidance the council is trying to provide as we update Chapter 4 of the Delta Plan, both in the form of recommendations and revised regulations, where projects are best suited to occur, level rise, what types of restoration attributes projects should pursue and are appropriate for the area, how they should best engage with locals. Those are all the topics that we're tackling in that draft ecosystem amendment that's currently out for review and soon will be subject to environmental analysis for more public.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
And with that, I think we'll see if Campbell Ingram from the Delta Conservancy is on the line.
I'm here. Good morning.
Campbell, the floor is all yours.
Great. Good morning, Chair Tassayan and council members. It's great to be with you this morning to give you an update. We had our board meeting yesterday in the morning, and the Conservancy continues to be open for business. We're working 100% from home and, of course, having our board meetings on Zoom like you all are. I did have a little write-up in our board packet about our 10-year anniversary. Like the Stewardship Council, the Delta Conservancy turns 10 this year. Staff came online early in 2010, and then we had our first board meeting in March of 2010. And I shared with the board that this anniversary kind of snuck up on me until I read Jessica Pearson's blog on the Stewardship Council's 10-year anniversary, and it triggered that, yes, we, in fact, 10 years old. Too. It is a momentous occasion and opportunity to look back on the things that we've achieved. I'll give a little bit of update on Proposition 1 and Proposition 68 programs and the funding that we're moving. But I think by and large, we've met our statutorily created purpose, which is to be a partner to the Delta community and then show that the state can work in partnership with the community to do ecosystem restoration and economic development. So we're very proud of our achievements over the last 10 years and feel like we're really well situated to do great things in the future. Obviously, funding is going to be a major driver there. If well resourced, we should be able to do great things, be able to continue to do great things. So I want to give you a little bit of an update on our Proposition 1 program and then Prop 68, and then I'll talk a little bit about our carbon work too. So I think Proposition 1 goes really to the heart of Maria's questions earlier. We are an implementer of ecosystem restoration. In the Delta, we have $50 million from Proposition 1. Over the last 4 years, we've run four solicitations, open solicitations for projects. We now have 29 projects on the ground affecting about 8,000 acres in the Delta. Now, all those projects vary widely in terms of the types of habitat that we're creating, but they are all reviewed by independent experts, as well as they must demonstrate local support and a recognition that these projects fit well within the fabric of the Delta system and the local communities. And so, again, we're very proud of the fact that there's local support for all 29 of those projects moving forward. One of the other things that we did early on with some of our Proposition 1 planning money is we did bring together various planning efforts where we would take our region of the Delta and try to work with local interests as well as scientific experts and all the agencies to help really at a regional, more sort of a more drilled down regional scale. Where does restoration make the most sense? How do you think about where you can get the most value for ecosystem restoration, but also have the least amount of impact on the agricultural systems and the economic viability of the region? So I think probably the best example of that is our public land strategy that came out early in 2019. So anyway, I think those nest nicely under the Chapter 4 revision, and ultimately they provide us a pretty good framework and architecture about where we best do restoration, where it works the best within the Delta existing systems, and tries to maintain economic viability as well. We're very excited that our Proposition 68 program is now up and running. This is our community and economic enhancement grant program. We have $12 million for that. We have received 11 concept proposals, currently reviewing nine. We've invited five of those back to develop full proposals. We're in the process of reviewing three more of those now, and then two were ultimately deemed not consistent with the program and will not be moving forward. But it's our first block of money to actually be doing some sort of economic development in the Delta. And there's a pretty wide variety. There's some there's public access projects. There's visitor centers. There are trails. There are museums and parks. So it really is an opportunity to work with the community, put some state funds on the ground, and hopefully help the overall viable economic vitality of the Delta. Those projects will continue to be reviewed, and then hopefully we start. It's really a non-competitive, ongoing solicitation. So hopefully we start to see some projects trickle in with recommendations to the board for funding in the coming months. By the end of the year, early next year, we hope to see several coming through. Last thing I want to talk about a little bit was about our Delta carbon work, and we've talked in the past about all the work that we're doing. I just want to preface by saying that really where we're focused at here is in the most deeply subsided area of the Delta, about 200,000 acres in sort of the central and western Delta that is typically characterized by low-value crops, corn, alfalfa, and pasture, because that is what you can grow on the most deeply subsided area. So recognizing the threat that subsidence presents to the California water supply, as well as a very, very large carbon emission, we've been doing a lot of work through the years trying to get a carbon protocol developed and get pilot projects out there that really can demonstrate that there's a carbon revenue stream that is commensurate with ag lease values currently. In the future, it'll hopefully be commensurate with just ag values in the area. And I'll talk just a little bit about that in a minute. But in any event, trying to provide economic incentives to really look at ways that we could change agricultural practice out there and stop subsidence that creates this great threat, as well as the carbon emission. Protocol covers two practices. Basically, to stop subsidence, you simply have to re-wet the surface. You have to resaturate that ground, so you can do managed wetland or you can do rice cultivation. What I really want to share with you is just a groundswell of activity since the last time I provided an update for you. We're seeing an increased number of pilot projects, as well as just interest from the outside world. So starting with increased pilot projects, I shared with you last time that we were doing third-party validation of carbon credits for three wetland projects for DWR. That process is wrapping up, and it represents the first time that wetland credits for our carbon market have been certified anywhere ever. And now DWR is doing another managed wetland. They're doing groundbreaking on another managed wetland. The Nature Conservancy has converted several hundred acres to rice cultivation on Staten Island, and they're looking at doing more next year. And they're also then doing about 1,000 acres of managed wetland on Staten Island. A very prominent Delta rice farmer, who we all know and love, is converting, he's a farmer now, but he's converting over 1,000 acres to rice in the near term. Actually, that's happening right now. And the Conservancy, with our team of consultants, is working with both TNC and this farmer to do what we did for DWR, which is give them the technical assistance to estimate their carbon credits, pay for the third-party validation to get those credits certified, and then help them connect through contracts to a carbon market and get a revenue stream moving forward. So it's very exciting that we're starting to see more interest and more people willing to take us up on our offer to help them get revenue streams from the carbon market. Also very exciting, last week had a meeting with the California Air Resources Board Compliance Offset Task Force. And this task force was created by the legislature, recognizing that we will need more viable carbon protocols to be able to meet the need for carbon offsets in the future. So there is a wetland subgroup, and we were able to sit down with them and provide them an overview of the whole Delta picture, the carbon protocol, how it was developed, how it works, and then how all the pilot projects and where we see the system going. They were very excited about that, and clearly, you know, that will be one of the protocols that they consider recommending to be adopted into the CARB compliance program. Now, that's really important because right now, working in the voluntary carbon space, we can get about $62 per acre net, which competes with ag lease value. But if we get into that compliance market, we get about $180 per acre net, which outcompetes most commodities that are grown in the Western Delta. So we're very hopeful that that process moves forward, and just very excited to see their interest and excitement in looking at that protocol. Another meeting that same day, met with the SMUD board, and they had actually provided about a quarter of the funding to help develop the protocol that was developed back in 2017. And just to give them an update, show them where we're headed, and they're very focused on trying to offset their current emissions and even really thinking about how to offset their past and historic emissions. They see the Delta as a very fertile ground for projects that are very relevant to their community and their region. And so we'll be having further conversations with them about the types of pilot projects that they might want to be able to engage in. Last week was a great week for carbon. I mean, you know, it was just a lot of great exchanges. But I was contacted by a consultant for the Pew Charitable Trust. And the Pew Charitable Trust is really looking very seriously at getting more engaged in blue carbon. And that led them to Delta Carbon, which is sort of blue carbon. So had a really nice conversation with them about, again, just giving them the overall picture, where we see this headed, the significance of the issue. And again, very excited. They will be reporting back to the Pew with a section about the Delta, and anticipated that they would want to reach out to our team and get more information. So another, you know, potential partner and, a partner that's willing to bring some funding to the table. So I think I'll stop there and entertain any questions, and always appreciate the opportunity to provide you all an update.
Looks like Randy has a question.
I have a comment. Campbell, you must be very encouraged. It feels like a tipping point in terms of finding the financial resources and outside interests to help move farming to a more sustainable approach. That $180 an acre figure is significant. And I know that we've talked about, if we could just get $150, we could incentivize growers to change their practices. It sounds like you're almost there. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It does. It definitely feels like we're reaching a threshold where we might really pick up some significant momentum. So,
hi, this Danny. Is Daniel. Just to echo Randy's comment, to hear you say last week was a good week for carbon was a rare moment of optimism in a difficult situation we're all in. So it's good to hear and the details too.
Yes, thank you, Campbell, for all your diligent, relentless focus. And it's really wonderful that the carbon opportunity is actually opening up. That's so exciting that you've got some major forces within the Delta willing to experiment.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
Thank you.
Well, are there any other questions for Campbell? Maria, looks like you're still on mute.
You're on mute, Maria.
Oh, okay. There she is.
That's better. So my question, I think some of the questions, Campbell, that I asked before, probably you can shed some light on. And you talked about coming up with certain kind of a development that or some certain kind of projects that includes public benefit and a number of other things, restoration and the levies and all that together. I was wondering, are these already started, these projects, or it's just the methodology with which you arrive at certain kind of projects like that? But it's no different than doing development or, you know, multi-benefit projects anywhere else in a way. Of course, it has its specific, but it's according to a matrix of, you know, evaluation of certain criteria and in something like that. I just wanted to hear from you about that.
Sure. If I understand your question right, I'll try and then and maybe you can steer me if I'm a little off. But particularly for the carbon work, I mean, there's a bowl out there in the Delta that's extremely deeply subsided. And the whole area is really ripe and rich for re-wetting that land to stop subsidence and try to stop to reverse subsidence through these practices. There are secondary benefits of providing additional waterfowl habitat and amphibian habitat and aquatic invertebrate habitat. We're even looking at the potential that, you know, we know that the channels of the surrounding delta are food deplete. It's not functioning as an aquatic ecosystem. And if we pump water off of these wetlands behind levees, you might actually be providing primary production, food production into these channels as well. So if your question gets to where do you know how to do, where to do this work in the Delta, you're really simply just looking for the deepest areas of the Delta, where that difference between the levee and the river is just, you know, because that's your highest percentage of carbon and your greatest opportunity to do that. And it's just now you can see it on some of the older maps. It's just sort of that red and orange zone of most deeply subsided area in the Western Delta. Now, when I think that's a fundamental shift from your earlier questions about where do we do tidal habitat and floodplain habitat. And that's, you know, that's where we're looking slightly outside of that deeply subsided zone in the Delta. But you can, you know, there's some overlap there. And again, there's efforts to, very scientific efforts, both in Chapter 4 and with particularly with San Francisco Estuary Institute, to really try to identify where we would try to recreate some of those ecological functions most effectively in the Delta.
Thank you.
Campbell, is there anything further the council could do to help affirm the need for economic incentives at an appropriate level to incentivize sustainable farming?
You know, if you'd asked me that 6 months ago, I would say that we definitely want to see as much support as we can get in the discussions of bond funding, right? Because again, converting these lands does cost money, and we were very hopeful that we had done quite a bit of work and expecting to see a pretty good chunk of money in whichever, you know, climate resilience bond or FSB 45 that would ultimately move forward. Sadly, you know, the talk of those moving forward has simply dried up. So, you know, funding is always an issue. I think communication, just it helping to keep the issue in the forefront in the right places within the legislature, and even in work with partners and outreach to partners, I think is really important. But I'm open to other suggestions and other ways that we can partner to push it along too. All right, well, thank you.
Thanks, Campbell.
Thank you, Campbell. Thank you for your leadership on that issue. Unless there are any other questions, that concludes my executive officer's report, Chair Tatayan.
Great, thank you. Council members, any other questions for Jessica?
Thank you.
Okay, is there any public comment?
There's no public comment.
Okay. Well, in that case, let's move on to agenda item 6, lead scientist report with Dr. John.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question before we move on? I guess I know there were some revisions to the agenda, and I just want to make sure I'm tracking correctly, but the agenda that I have has that as item 9, and I'm confused by it. I just wanted to double check. Maybe staff can help me, but unless I got the wrong version of the July 23rd agenda.
So, Oscar, your agenda numbers are correct. Since we didn't have a closed session, we didn't change the numbers, but they look slightly different on Susan's agenda. But the numbers are correct on the actual notice.
Very good. Okay, just to make sure I didn't miss anything. Thank you, Lita.
You're welcome.
Great. Well, then I will get started. So, good morning, Chair Tatayan and council members. I have an article to talk about and a number of upcoming events, actually a few articles. So I'll jump right into the recent paper that's included in the written update. So if we could have the virtual abstract posted. And I'll start. So this article is a synthesis of Suisun Bay fish data over the last 20 years. The lead author is Denise Colombano, and she did this with colleagues from UC Davis, including Peter Moyle, who's done work on local fish more than anyone in Suisun or the Delta, just about. Also, I should note that Dr. Colombano was supported in her work on this project as a Delta Science Fellow. So for this work, they evaluated the importance of various habitat characteristics in a gradient from the edge of the estuary and big channels up to the upland areas. And they did this for looking at 4 of the most common fish species in Suisun Marsh: the Sacramento splittail, the tule perch, starry flounder, and also striped bass, the one non-native but really abundant fish species in this group. These are 4 of the most common fish species in Suisun Marsh. So they looked at 22 years of monitoring data across 9 different sloughs or tidal creeks in Suisun Marsh. And they wanted to look at how fish abundance and growth related to habitat features across those different areas. Features like the size and depth of the slough, the sinuosity, the adjacent habitats, and then also looking at flow and water quality, really salinity issues, and how that would affect fish abundance. So what they found is that a mosaic of habitat conditions, as well as the importance of the connectivity between land and water, is what really supported this mix of species. They found that habitat preference across the 4 different species varied. Some species used the deep channels on the edge of the marsh. Others were found in the really small channels within the marsh. And importantly, habitat preference for the species changed as the fish matured from juveniles to adults. So that really highlights the importance of this connectivity between habitats if we're going to provide nursery support for fish populations. So looking at the figure there with the 2 different images, what they concluded was that effective restoration and management really does need to incorporate this mosaic of connected habitats that reflects the dynamic conditions that are found in the natural sloughs. The top figure is an idealized picture of natural sloughs. And really what, in terms of restoration, we don't need to create exactly that complete natural landscape, but we do need to have a mix of habitats, and connectivity is really essential. So that, those are their findings and recommendations. And this, I think, really directly reflects the recommendations in the update to Chapter 4 on the Delta Plan, with the emphasis on process-based restoration and connectivity as a key way to improve conditions for fish and for other species in the Delta and the estuary. So any questions on this paper?
John, I don't have a question, but I want to compliment the visual abstract here. Wonderful way of boiling the concepts down.
Great. I'm glad you appreciate those. And Byron Riggins, the Sea Grant Fellow, put this together. So I will convey your thanks on to Byron.
Yeah. John, this is Randy. I didn't notice in the executive summary any reference to predation. And I'm wondering what an overlay of predation hotspots would look like on this map.
So that's a great question and a segue. In addition, they didn't really look at predation, but I wanted to briefly include two other papers and one paper that specifically focuses on predation and that I know we had talked about over the last few weeks. So I'll briefly talk about two other papers. I don't have a visual abstract for them, but I think they're really good companions to this paper. So this paper really highlights the importance of habitat and connectivity issues. Two other papers. The first one is a paper of a 2017 field study that was in the South Delta on specifically on predation of juvenile Chinook salmon. This was done by Cyril Michael and his colleagues at NOAA and as well as colleagues from UC Davis and other institutions. So they used a really innovative system to measure and evaluate predation rates with drifting buoys that record environmental conditions that have a juvenile salmon connected to that buoy, so they know exactly when and where predation is occurring and what the associated conditions are with predation. So they documented relatively fine scale patterns of predation in the South Delta. They found that predation rates were highest, as you might guess, when a predator is nearby. Also when water temperature was warmer, turbidity affected predation, as did the presence of submerged aquatic vegetation. And they also found, they put these buoys and tethered fish out in the afternoons, early evenings. They found that just in the few minutes before sunset and right after sunset was exactly when the highest rates of predation were occurring, which is what any fisherman would tell you as well. So these results really confirmed the hotspots for predation, such as the Head of Old River. But with this fine scale data, they were able to put together a model of overall predation rates. This was in 2017 with relatively high flows. They can't compare within different predation across years, but within that year, they can get a very good understanding of the fine scale impacts of predation, which were relatively significant. Their recommendations were to think about a mix of approaches. Predator removal at hotspots could have some effect, although in another paper they did, they found that that was really challenging to keep predator numbers low without really significant efforts in removing them. But they also highlighted that given the impacts, the relationship between temperature and timing of predation, that if you can release, for the hatchery fish, if you can release them earlier and get them downstream when temperatures are cooler, they're likely to have lower predation rates. And then they also highlight the importance of habitat restoration and creating refuges for these fish. So a suite of different activities that might reduce predation rates. And if you're interested, I'd be happy to provide you more details on their work or provide you with a copy of that paper. And then I'll just, the third paper I'll highlight very briefly. This was a paper that came out last year on they looked at two decades of flow modifications and Chinook salmon migration and returns on the Stanislaus River. This was by Dr. Anna Sturrock and her colleagues. What they found was, for the Stanislaus, what they found was that lower and less variable flows were associated with fewer migrating juveniles. So with greater flows and more variable flows within a year, you're going to get more juveniles migrating out. And also those lower flows and less variable flows resulted in fewer returning adults. Obviously, there's a mix of factors affecting the returning adults. But also they found that the flow modifications, the reduction in the variability of flows on the rivers can lead to a reduction in the timing of when the migration occurs and reduced genetic diversity within the population. Even the high level of natural variability that is in flows that's existed in our river systems over time, this has resulted in fish populations that have a very diverse mix of individuals in terms of their timing of when they're going to migrate. Some migrate early, some migrate mid-season, some migrate later in the late part of the spring. But modified flows now are selecting for a really much less diverse population. And so what we need to think about is that loss of diversity, especially with climate change, will reduce the resilience of these populations to be able to respond to future changes. So, as with the other papers, they acknowledge it's not just flow modifications that are causing these changes. Loss of habitat, warming temperatures are also affecting the diversity of the fish populations. But I think altogether, these three papers really highlight the mix of factors that are affecting fish populations: habitat and connectivity, predation, temperature, flow in a variety of different ways. And so if we want to have an effective restoration effort, we really need to think about all of those different factors to improve conditions for fish. No single one is, given how impacted the populations have been, no single one is going to be a magic tool that's going to cause, you know, incredible responses. But really, we need to think about addressing all of those. So any questions on any of those papers? And as I said, I'd be happy to provide you with details on the last two.
Yeah, I'd like to receive those, John.
I would as well. Thank you, John.
Sure.
Any other questions from the council members?
John, does that complete your report?
No, so I have a few items after, besides the papers. So I'll dive in.
Don't leave without allowing me to make a comment.
Okay, so in your report, there's a summary of the science needs assessment, the pre-workshop discussion series, and I've mentioned this in the past. Remember that the science needs assessment is an effort that's co-hosted by the Delta Independent Science Board and the DPIC. It's been developed over the last 6 to 8 months and has grown out of the Science and Funding Governance Initiative that's been going on for a number of years. The goals for this workshop are to identify science that will address long-term management challenges, especially those around climate change, and then to discuss how to organize the science enterprise to address those challenging long-term issues. And this effort is closely associated with the Science Action Agenda update. The Science Action Agenda looks at short-term, immediate management needs and with the relevant science, whereas the science needs assessment is looking at longer term climate change focused issues. So the workshop is planned for October. It originally was planned for the spring, but had to be postponed. And given the postponement, we've had a series of pre-workshop discussions. We've already had two so far that have been really successful with close to 100 participants for each of the discussions online. The next one will be coming up Tuesday morning, July 28th at 9:15. It'll feature Denise Conrad from the Science Program and the Council, Mike Chakowski from USGS, and Stephanie Frong from California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Interagency Ecological Program. And it'll have a focus on the science that's needed to address these long-term climate change related issues that we've been discussing in the previous discussion series. Then the last discussion will take place September 9th with the workshop occurring in early October. I mentioned the science needs assessments closely connected to the science action agenda. That we will give you a more detailed overview of the update to the science action agenda in the coming months. But remember that the science action agenda is a a critical document that identifies the science actions needed to meet current management needs. And the current science action agenda was developed back in 2017 and runs through 2021. It's a science program-led effort, but with broad community engagement. And the effort to update it is already underway, given that we really want to facilitate this broad engagement. The focus of the science action agenda is on these science actions, but the update is intentionally starting with identification of management questions. And this is driven by the recommendation from DPIC and others to link management questions to science actions. So there will be a workshop on management questions September 29th. And as I said, we'll give you a much more detailed overview of that in the coming months. And then there's also information in your update on the science, the Spring Run Chinook Salmon Science Workshop. You know, we put on a number of workshop and symposium. This workshop will assess current knowledge and data gaps for Spring Run Chinook Salmon in the Sacramento Valley. And it will inform the development of population estimates for that the Central Valley Spring Run Chinook Salmon, something that is one of the key recommendations from the Biological Goals Advisory Panel that we've talked about in the past. And this is being supported by the science program in coordination with the Department of Water Resources and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. It will be September 8th to 10th, 3 half days. It will be online as all of our meetings are now. And so as a way to try to break things up and engage people, rather than have one long day, we'll have 3 short half days to discuss these issues. And then not in your, in my summary, but important events coming up as well is the IEP workshop. So remember, the IEP is the Interagency Ecological Program that is tasked with completing monitoring to evaluate effects of the water projects, as well as just get a better, broader understanding of the Delta's ecosystem. Their workshop is normally held in the spring, but it was postponed until the fall. It now is going to occur online. They also are going to break it up. So it's going to be be 10 2-hour sessions on Tuesdays and Thursdays from August 25th to October 13th with the same topics that would have been covered in the in-person workshop. So that will be happening this fall. And then in the spring, the Bay Delta Science Conference normally occurs in the fall, but is going to be occurring in spring 2021. This also will be fully virtual. It will be held in March or April. A save the date for the conference will be coming out very soon, so keep your eyes out for that. The call for abstracts will occur in September or October. This will be held jointly with IEP as well. So IEP will participate in the Bay Delta Science Conference jointly for the first time. And then I encourage you to look at the By the Numbers report that Byron Riggins also put together for you. And that highlights, you know, relatively low precipitation. We're at about 60 to 70% of precipitation. And similarly, relatively low rates in flow. Reservoir levels slightly higher than that, given the management concern of holding some water back for if we may be going into a longer term drought conditions. So that is all I have to cover. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, John. Are there any questions for John, council members? And I think Randy wanted to say something.
Yes. John, will you be providing us a lead scientist report next month?
No, I will not, Randy. I'll be teaching class at University of San Francisco. Probably, I don't know exactly. No, my class is Monday, Wednesday, but unfortunately I will not be here.
Well, I just wanted to express my sincere appreciation for the 3 years of service that you have so faithfully provided to the Stewardship Council as the lead scientist. I personally have benefited tremendously during my full-time service when we operated next door to each other in the office. I know I was constant pest to you, asking questions and offering thoughts, and you were always so patient and so thoughtful in the way you followed through and provided information. You have been an outstanding mentor to our staff. And you have been able to bridge that science and policy divide. Bringing science to inform policymakers is very hard to do, and you've done it tremendously. Your quarterly reports to the State Water Resources Control Board have helped to inform those decision makers about current science and the need to apply that to important decisions. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you. And Susan and Jessica, John provided a summary at the end of the three science reports talking about the comprehensive nature of addressing fish needs in the Delta, that there is no silver bullet. I wish you could post his summary comment and make it available. There are so many people that think, well, if we only did this or if we only did that, we could fix things. And John, I thought your summary was brilliant. And I think it reflects a little bit of frustration, you know, that we just can't seem to get our arms around everything we need to do to conditions. With that, thank you very much. It's been an honor and a pleasure to serve with you.
Thank you, Randy. I really appreciate your kind words. And I've really just truly enjoyed the opportunity to interact with all of you. I got to interact much more with Susan and Randy through your role as chairs. And but all of you, I've really enjoyed it. I appreciate your interest and engagement on science issues. I truly appreciate the council's commitment to using science to guide policy. I would say that the staff at the science program and the entire council really deserve all the credit. The lead scientist job is an easy job, given how great the staff is. They really should get all of the credit, because they do all the work that I get the chance to talk to you about. So I've truly enjoyed it. I definitely have some regrets leaving and going back to USF. I'm excited to go back to teaching, but I really will miss the opportunity to interact with all of you and to stay engaged on all these really super interesting and challenging issues. And also I should acknowledge the Delta Independent Science Board, which as well really provides just an incredible contribution. And that aspect of the job as Delta lead scientist and interacting with them also just is a real joy to do, given their commitment and their knowledge and engagement. So I thank you very much. And I do plan to stay engaged, even though I'll be in the Bay. I definitely look forward to more interactions. And one of my interests is connecting Bay and Delta issues. And I think where I've been able to do that from the Delta side, I look forward to connecting from the Bay side as well.
Susan?
Yeah, yes, Judge.
Yeah, I just wanted to second the comments made by Randy, in particular, bridging the noticeable gap between science and policy. That's something you did brilliantly. And I really appreciate that, John.
Thank you, Judge Damrell. I appreciate that.
Yes, Oscar.
Yeah, I would echo exactly what Randy and the judge just said. That bridging component, certainly for me, has been tremendous, John. You've for lack of a better description, you've dumbed it down in a way that has really helped me appreciate and value the science behind the work in the Delta. Most of the work that I get to engage in doesn't have a science component built into it, probably for good reason. But the Delta, because of the delicate nature of the work that is occurring, requires it. And it can be intimidating as a policymaker to have an element of science embedded in the work that we do. But you made it so simple. You bridged it, as I said before, in a perfect way. So thank you very much for your commitment to the Delta and for your commitment to making sure that the policy makers have the appropriate amount of science embedded in the work that we do. So thank you.
Thank you, Oscar.
Yes, thank you, John. I just want to take a moment to let the council members and public know that the Delta Plan Interagency Implementation Committee members also spoke very highly of John. We're aware that John took science and policy communication to the next level. And John, I will miss you very much. John, in addition to being a terrific lead scientist, is also a diplomat and advisor and a leader in so many ways. He inspires curiosity and learning and educates in a way that is so effective. Well, I'll miss you a lot, John.
Thank you, Susan. I've truly enjoyed interacting with you. I've certainly missed the chance to be in the office and to chat more regularly.
Thank you, John, for all your answering the questions that were so off about science from all of
never making no questions are off. No bad questions, no dumb questions. Truly.
John, we've really enjoyed your presence. It's going to be strange for me not having a second person from my high school on this board. And by the way, I think was very coincidental to begin with, which is really cool. But you've really been awesome. I mean, bringing science in an understandable, digestible way really takes massive skills. And I always look forward to hearing what you had to say every week. I took furious notes and, in many cases, I went home and read up more stuff about it. So you've made our job as commissioners a lot more interesting and a lot more informed. And we will stay in touch. I would love to, from time to time, ask you questions that are within your area of expertise, if that's okay with you.
Certainly. Happy to do that. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no other questions from the council, is there any public comment?
No public comment.
Great. Well, then let's move on to agenda item 10, Central Valley Flood Protection Plan update. I think Jessica will be kicking us off.
Thanks, Susan. Actually, I'm going to hand it off to our team, but I want to make sure that Brandon and everyone has the moment to get queued up here.
Yeah, I think they should all be on by now. Looks like I catch Jeff, Ruth, and Mary.
Okay.
Great. Jeff, thank you. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, Brandon. Good morning, Chair Chitayan. Good morning, council members. It's a pleasure to be here this morning to address the council with regard to the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan update, the 2022 update to that plan. I'll just offer a little bit of background, and then we'll ask Mary and Ruth to present to the council some deeper background on the plan and the update process that's underway at this point. And then I'll summarize at the end just with a few tiebacks to the Delta plan and some of the council's ongoing planning efforts. You'll recall, council members, that flood risk reduction is a key charge to the council with regard to a complementary approach to the co-equal goals and a focus on really reducing flood risks, particularly to state interests in the Delta. And that's emerged through Chapter 7 of the Delta Plan and the Delta Levees Investment Strategy most readily. But there is, this is another sort of multifaceted topic that has multiple plans that address flood risks. And the Delta is a part of the overall Central Valley. And so there is a role for the Delta Plan and the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan to work in concert to address some of the state's most pressing risk reduction goals for flood control and the Delta. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and hand it over to Mary and Ruth. And just quickly, by way of introduction, Mary Jimenez is with DWR's Division of Multi-Benefit Initiatives and is leading development of the 2022 Central Valley Flood Protection Plan update. And Ruth Darling is the staff lead for the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan on behalf of the Central Valley Flood Protection Board. So this morning we'll be hearing both from the Department of Water Resources and the Flood Board. And Mary, with that, please go ahead and take it away.
Thank you, Jeff, and good morning, council members. I'd like to start by handing over to Ruth Darling. She's going to cover the first part of our presentation this morning on our overview of the flood protection plan. And I'm going to continue on where Ruth leaves off to give you a little bit more about our 2022 update and how we're looking forward to continuing to work together with the Stewardship Council moving forward. So with that, Ruth, if you're ready.
And Brandon, do you have the presentation handy?
I believe Ruth and
Ruth has it.
Okay. Mary wanted to present.
Great, thank you.
Mary, are you going to share your screen?
I can if they needed me to. I wasn't sure if Brandon was going to pull it up.
Oh, I have it on hand. I can go ahead and I'll post it.
Okay, thank you.
Take it away.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the introduction, Jeff. My name is Ruth Darling. I'm a program manager for the Central Valley Flood Protection Board. And I just want to say thank you for inviting us to present on the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, Chairwoman Tutayan, Council Members, and Executive Officer Pearson. It's a pleasure to be here today. Next slide, please. Okay, just to start off, what is the plan? The plan is a strategic plan to improve flood risk management in the Central Valley. Since its initial adoption in 2012, the plan has guided flood risk management investments to improve emergency preparedness and response capabilities, as well as increase critical flood protection in California's Central Valley and address maintenance deficiencies in the flood system. The Central Valley Flood Protection Plan describes a system-wide flood management planning approach. The system includes 1,600 miles of levees, 380 miles of those are in the Delta. There's an extensive system of bypasses and floodways. Several areas are in deep floodplains, and it also encompasses two major, very different river basins, including the Sacramento and San Joaquin basins. Each of those contain over five major rivers. So the plan covers a diverse landscape, including major urban centers, rural and small communities, agriculture habitat, as well as critical infrastructure. Next slide, please. So this is from your fact sheet in the council member packet. So recognizing that the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan was formulated to address flood risk to a wide variety of sectors, including the ones called out here on your slide. So there's significant risk in the Central Valley, and recognizing that risk changes over time, this is why five-year updates to the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan are important. Next slide, please. So just an overview of the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan. In accordance with the requirements of the Central Valley Flood Protection Act of 2008, as well as California Water Code Section 9600 through 9625, DWR is to develop the plan, and the Central Valley Flood Protection Board adopts the plan. And there are updates every 5 years, in years ending in 2 and 7. It's a strategic long-range plan that describes a programmatic vision for flood system improvements. The Central Valley Flood Protection Plan is a descriptive document. It's not decisional. It's not a funding or permitting decision for specific projects. It includes recommendations on investments and policies to support comprehensive flood risk management, actions locally, regionally, and system-wide, rather than promoting specific projects. Next slide, please. So the goals of the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, the primary goal is to improve flood risk management, and that is to reduce the chance of flooding and damages once flooding occurs, improve public safety, preparedness, and emergency response. In addition, there are four supporting goals to the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan, as shown on the slide, which is improve operation and maintenance, promote ecosystem functions, improve institutional support, and promote multi-benefit projects. Next slide, please. So compatible responsibility, again, DWR prepares the plan and works toward implementation of the plan, as well as provides technical assistance, administers financial assistance programs, and operates and maintains parts of the central, of the state plan of flood control facilities. And the Central Valley Flood Protection Board adopts the plan, as well as works towards implementation of the plan. We're also the non-federal sponsor for state plan of flood control facilities and projects. We administer encroachment permits through our regulatory role, and we also provide a public forum for stakeholder engagement through several board committees, as well as our monthly board meetings. Next slide, please. So this slide provides a snapshot of the flood planning area, as well as an intersection between the legal delta, the delta plan area. And those are shown downstream of each river basin, outlined in red and orange. So we just wanted to highlight the intersection of both planning areas. Next slide, please. And this slide is to help outline the importance of the local and regional input into the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan process. So DWR funded six regionally led flood management plans. And these describe local and regional flood management priorities, challenges, and potential funding mechanisms, along with site-specific improvement needs. These plans provide valuable perspectives from regional and local flood managers to help inform and align the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan investment strategies and implementation. And the RFMPs also provide a platform for meaningful engagement among the state and local and regional flood planners across both river basins. So the yellow outline in the titles, the Lower Sacramento Delta North region, as well as the Lower San Joaquin and Delta South region, both included planning recommendations for the Delta area. So because the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan is a system-wide plan supported by details contained in the RFMPs, we wanted to highlight this, the RFMP process to you. And in addition, the Central Valley Flood Protection Board provides a public venue for stakeholders to engage the state on flood management activities, including the plan. So the board has shown the importance of the local and regional perspectives through several committees that are designed to inform and engage stakeholders and solicit feedback from the community and stakeholders, as well as in addition to our monthly board meetings. And with that, I'd like to turn the next slide over to Mary.
Thank you. Am I unmuted? Okay. Thank you, Ruth, council members. I'm happy to take over here for the next. So bridging off of what Ruth covered, she mentioned the Central Valley Flood Protection Act of 2008. In compliance with that act, we produced the 2012 Central Valley Flood Protection Plan in 2012. That was adopted by the board in June of that year. In that plan, we introduced the state system-wide investment approach and identified the goals and strategies to implement the CVFPP over a 30-year horizon, consistent with that authorizing legislation. A body of deeper work went into preparation of the 2017 Central Valley Flood Protection Plan update that I'll touch on in a bit. But in short, that first five-year update refined the state system-wide approach that had been introduced 5 years prior and was organized around two foundational themes that you'll see on the slide here. The first is integration with broader water resources objectives, more commonly known to all of us today as multi-benefit. And the second is the need for sustainable funding for flood system investments. Looking ahead towards our next five-year update in 2022, we're organizing this flood plan update around the foundational themes you'll see on the slide here. The first that we're tackling is climate resilience. The second is reporting of implementation accomplishments and progress, also known as performance tracking. And the third is demonstrating alignment with other state efforts, as you will see shortly, notably including the Delta Plan. Next slide, please. A little bit more about the 2017 Central Valley Flood Protection Plan update that was the last update adopted by the Flood Protection Board. That plan recommended investments of 17 to 21 billion over our 30-year planning horizon. I mentioned it was supported by a deep body of supporting technical and scientific work. Many of those documents may sound familiar to you already. One is the conservation strategy, the other is investment strategy. We also had a body of comprehensive climate change analyses performed that are all contained in our supporting documents. We also identified, as Ruth mentioned, major policy issues in the flood plan. Well, we had 8 of them identified in 2017 and made recommendations to address them. And what's important to understand about those policy issues is they were the latest and greatest at the time of what we felt working with our stakeholders were affecting our ability to implement the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan. So we really needed to dig in and understand those policy issues and try to make meaningful recommendations to address them moving forward. Next slide, please. A little bit more about how we're starting to develop our themes for 2022, starting with the climate change resilience theme. We're acknowledging that we're fortunate to live here in the state of California, where we're on the cutting edge of understanding the effects of a changing climate on our flood management system. Moving towards 2022, we have a great opportunity ahead of us to build upon the analyses done in 2012 and 2017 and be informed by new data, and continue to use a comprehensive risk management approach in the CVFPP to increase climate resilience and provide multiple benefits. Next slide, please. In thinking more about tracking accomplishments and performance, also known as performance tracking, we're going to, bridging off of our work in 2017, show that development of a comprehensive performance tracking system can be done to improve return on investment for state taxpayers and provide accountability. We have some ongoing efforts to develop a performance tracking system that we initiated after 2017 to track progress on implementing the CVFPP. It's still in its relative infancy, but we have some work ahead of us to move this forward in the next couple years, including consideration of both flood management and ecosystem restoration metrics, you know, as part of our multi-benefit plan. Next slide, please. And we're excited to explore and improve alignment with other state efforts that are changing as we speak. The 2022 update will align with the other state efforts that you see listed here on the slide. If I could put a flashing light around the third one listed, the Delta Plan, very happy to be here meeting with you all this morning to talk more about that. But also recognizing that we need to align with the governor's water resilience portfolio, our California Water Plan update 2023, the SGMA implementation, Bulletin 118, DWR's Climate Action Plan, and the Headwaters to Floodplain Initiative, Flood Safety Partnership, which is focused primarily on floodplain management and emergency response. Next slide, please. A little bit more about the Central Valley Flood Protection Plan and Delta Planning. I wanted to start by recognizing the current collaboration that is underway. There was a memorandum of understanding signed between DWR, the Flood Protection Board, and your council back in late 2017. There has been a working group meeting together regularly since early 2018 to better coordinate and collaborate on future Delta levy investments. The purpose of that working group is to really establish an effective working relationship between our agencies where we have overlapping authorities and responsibilities in the legal delta. So in the spirit of the MOU, we are also collaborating at the staff level on our climate change technical approaches. Very pleased to hear from staff that we are already enjoying productive discussions between the Delta Stewardship Council's Climate Initiative Delta Adapts and our CVFPP climate change analyses that we're preparing for 2022. Next slide, please. And there's areas to do even more together that I'm very excited about. So we are just getting going in thinking through a consistency determination to prepare for 2022. We are going to initiate early consultation at the staff level in the coming weeks on that. We also have opportunities ahead of us to collaborate on our performance tracking efforts and the theme in the flood protection plan, and explore ways that performance tracking system and information can help us meet our reporting requirements to the DSC on Delta program. And with that, next slide, please. I'll open up to questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Council members, any questions for Ruth or Mary or Jeff?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Oscar.
Yeah, it's not a question necessarily. It's a compliment, frankly. Both of you, thank you very much for your efforts. It's rare that a document of this size can hold my attention year after year. And I think part of it is because while I didn't get started necessarily on the right track from my perspective, from a local lens, you guys immediately shifted it to incorporate, and as you referenced, a lot of the recognition of the work that happens at the local level, and I represent county level of representation. I think it reflects a lot of heavy lifting that's occurring at the local level as well. So, albeit it's a statewide plan with regional statewide implications, there is an honest effort to incorporate local representation in an honest way, and it's required to be updated. So it's a living, breathing document, unlike a lot of these documents that oftentimes get helped and then get put on a shelf and collect dust. This one is a living, breathing document. And frankly, the way it's written is very easy to read and it's easy to understand. And so thank you for your work on this. I think the fact that the work that you're doing embeds so much of the other efforts that are happening throughout the entire region, as you mentioned, with the resiliency plan and the SGMA work. It focuses on precisely what I think is essential to our work, and that is the multi-benefit component and the sustainability efforts in terms of financing. So thank you for your work.
Thanks, Oscar. Randy.
Mary gave a very positive summary of the working relationship between the three agencies, and that was great news. It hasn't always been that smooth. So I appreciate that and thankful for the outcomes that are underway now under the Memorandum of Understanding. I wanted to ask Ruth, can you share with us your views about how well the three agencies are cooperating and working?
Sure. Unfortunately, I'm not heavily involved in the MOU meetings, but we get updates frequently from staff that are attending those meetings and the collaboration efforts. And it's always good feedback. They think it's similar to what Mary mentioned, that the collaboration is good for advancing the flood plan as well as the board's goals. So I've heard nothing but good things.
I should retire now. It's been an accomplishment. Thank you both. Thank you all, including Jeff.
So, Mary, I have a question, or Ruth. The conservation strategy to the flood plan, can you give a little bit more detail about the footprint area, the kinds of things that the strategies considering, how that aligns with other state programs such as Eco Restore or the Delta Plan's ecosystem amendment?
I can speak, this is Mary. I can speak briefly to the coverage of the planning area. It's similar to the planning area that you saw on the earlier slide, but we have conservation planning areas that go a little bit upstream up some of the tributaries. So it's a little bit broader than the slide that Ruth showed of our planning area, but very, very similar. So it has a very broad footprint. Is that an answer to your first question? But your second question about the specific contents. Mm-hmm. So we are we're organizing, you know, update of the contents of the 2017 strategy, basically the tools, strategies, and policies affecting multi-benefit project implementation and related topics. Right now, it's envisioned to be a more modest update of the deep body of work in 2017. We're just starting to scope it in a little bit more detail, working through the board's advisory committee into subtopics there. So that kind of engagement and more detailed scoping has just started to begin. So maybe we can follow up as that moves forward. I understand the Stewardship Council staff is also participating in that advisory committee and the groups that are going to be formed to dig into the contents in more detail.
Mm-hmm. Good news. Yeah, the conservation strategy is something near and dear to my heart. In a past life, I worked with some of the first flood protection plan folks and getting a conservation strategy going. And I'm so excited to see that it has, at least the 2017 version, brought in some details. And I was thinking for this update, it would be terrific if the flood plan at least alluded to or gave some kind of description of how the floodplains conservation strategy and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife's conservation strategy and the Delta Plan ecosystem amendment and Eco Restore, and there are all these conservation strategies and efforts to restore populations of various endangered species. And not that I'm asking the flood plan to do a detailed analysis, but at least inform the public that there are these other plans, here's how they connect, and here are the species and habitats that they hope to benefit. To show the public that these agencies are giving the public the most bang for the buck and actually thinking through these connections, that would be terrific.
I agree. That's a wonderful comment. Thank you.
Oscar, looks like you have a comment.
Yeah, you know, it just occurred to me. Yes, just it's a question. The 2017 plan, I remember, if I remember correctly, it had reference to the work that was going to be undertaken or was being undertaken as it relates to the NFIP program. A lot has occurred since then, and I just wondered if there is plans to update that portion of the plan, because I know that program, the National Flood Insurance Program, has its challenges. As we know, there has been some movement in some areas, and I just wondered if the update to the plan was intending on addressing kind of where we are relative to that issue, and whether or not there's going to be additional work in that area.
Yes, that's a wonderful comment as well. We do need to dig back into those policy issues from 2017 that included one is what's happening with the NFIP. So we do have an opportunity and a need to update that in 2022.
Okay, are there any other questions from council members? All right, how about any public comment?
Madam Chair, I had just a few closing remarks.
Oh, excuse me, Jeff.
I'd like to offer for the council, if that's possible.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm going to share my screen.
sorry, Jeff, I think I beat you to it.
Oh, you got it. Okay, thanks. So I just wanted to take just a few minutes and summarize for the council from sort of council staff's perspective, the overlaps between the Delta plan and the flood plan, but with really kind of taking a hard look at some of the ongoing activities that we have underway. And just again, looking at, for the Delta plan's key objectives really involve the co-equal goals and reducing flood risks to state interests. So you have the water supply components, the ecosystem components, the flooding, and Delta as an evolving place. As we've heard Mary and Ruth summarize some of the key objectives of the flood plan, a shared objective of reducing flood risks, improving operations and maintenance, shared objective of promoting ecosystem functions, and shared objectives with regard to promoting multi-benefit projects. And the way we see the flood plan really working integrally with some of the council's activities are illustrated in the center circle here between the Delta Levees investment strategy, our ongoing work on Delta Adapts, real overlaps, and we're hopeful for maybe some integrated approaches with regard to the flood plan's conservation strategy and the Delta Plan ecosystem amendment. We heard the department describe earlier the initiation of early consultation, which is something we very much welcome with regard to the flood plan, and we're actively engaged in setting up a structure for that now and contributing in meaningful ways to some of the hopefully to some of the content of the conservation strategy through the advisory committees that Mary had mentioned. And then there is this performance measures and performance tracking overlap, where the Delta plan has numerous performance measures that address reducing flood risk. The flood plan has, with this update in particular, a real emphasis on performance tracking. And so we're also hopeful to be able to align those in a way that they work together toward common outcomes. And then Brandon, if you could go to the next slide. Just wanted to highlight, where we understand the next steps heading, which is, DWR, as Mary had described, is in the process of developing a flood plan update for 2022, including the conservation strategy. And then at that point, DWR would also be the lead agency for the California Environmental Quality Act process to support adoption of the flood plan. The flood board would be a responsible agency under CEQA and would then take action to adopt that flood plan update, at which point we anticipate the DWR would prepare and file a certification of consistency for the flood plan update with the Delta plan. And following that, both DWR and the flood board would be engaged in implementing the flood plan update. So this provides you just a kind of a really big picture roadmap for where we're headed from here. We're just at the very start of the arrows on this diagram and look forward to working with Mary and with Ruth and with their staffs and with the flood board in particular as well, with regard to kind of how we step through these arrows and get to successful implementation of the 2022 flood plan update in a manner that's consistent with the Delta plan. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Council members, do you have any questions for Jeff? Okay.
If I could say something.
Yeah,
sure.
Go ahead, Maria.
I just wanted to say that the last two slides were kind of brought everything together, and thank you for them. Good. We heard the presentations, and then now we see how it all comes together. Thank you. And thank you, Mary and Drew. It's great.
I was going to say the same. In fact, the other day I was talking to Jeff, and I just said, these processes are pretty complex for the uninitiated, but who they affect and what they affect couldn't be more important. I mean, this is people, this is property, this is the values of the Delta, and these are pretty complex processes, but for good reason. And I said, Jeff, if only there was like a Venn diagram of how all these fit together. And he had already prepared that slide. And I said, this is perfect. It really helps show kind of where the overlap is between our respective departments on this matter and how important it is, essential it is for us to be working together and showing the public that we're a unified front and that we can pursue these policy options in a consistent manner. Thank you. Thank you for being here, Mary and Ruth.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Thank you, Jessica, for summing it up. Let me check again. Is there any public comment?
No public comment.
Okay. Well, then let's move on, wrapping things up. Is there any public comment on anything in general, not on the agenda?
There's no public comment for any general topics.
Okay. Then I'll conclude by letting folks know that our next council meeting is August 27 and will again be virtual. With that, thank you everybody for being here today. Be safe and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.